brought to you by Penguin.
Hello and welcome to the Penguin podcast, where we talk to writers about writing. I'm Izzy Sutty, and today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Chris Van Tulleken, whose new book, Ultra Processed People, launches on the 27th of April. An award-winning broadcaster, as well as a practicing NHS doctor and an academic, in this new book, Chris forensically examines the history of ultra processed food and its social role in our diet. And he uses his own experience to explain its effects on our health and our planet. Hello, Chris. It's great to talk to you today. Welcome to the Penguin podcast.
It is so nice to be here.
Good. So I loved this book. It's so detailed. It's been to Portugal and back with me while I ate food absolutely loaded with UPF. Thought about the book the whole time.
I was very pleased to see that your copy does seem to have been read, or at least it's covered in food and heavily dog-eared.
It really is. We've got the corners turned over. It's got a foundation on it. For me, that's a sign of a book well read. I hate keeping books pristine, but that's for another podcast. It really is so detailed and so thoroughly researched. Lots of footnotes, but interwoven with your own experience, which is what made it so accessible for someone like me who only did GCSE science. And I didn't know anything about UPF. If you said to me, is a ready meal ultra-processed food? I would go, yeah, probably. Yeah. It's got a plastic lid on it and it's got a long list of ingredients. So there was a bit where you talk about your colleagues at hospital going to Pret. And I was like, oh, Pret. Well, that's somewhere where everything's made fresh.
Yeah.
That's their
it's
kind
fine.
Of vibe.
Yeah, yeah, it's organic, I
and
think.
And I was like, oh, no, that's not the case. And is that a lot of people's reaction? That they kind of go, oh, right, this thing that I thought was really healthy actually does contain processed ingredients?
Yes. So the origin of the definition came because the scientists were trying to describe these problems of what we call Western life, or the sort of rich northwest bits of the globe, and all these diseases we have that seem to be linked to diet. And they were trying to create a definition of junk food because we don't have a definition. So a lot of people, I think, have that instinct of going, I know instinctively what McDonald's and KFC and ready meals, that they probably aren't that healthy, but that all supermarket bread, I think, or almost all bread that's in your Pret sandwiches or any other high street sandwiches, ultra processed. I think that surprises people. And that surprised the people who came up with the definition and did all the science. Carlos Montero didn't want to include bread in the definition. He said, you know, this is staple food. Surely it can't be ultra processed, but it is.
Carlos Montero, who you talk about quite a lot, made up this, well, it's called the NOVA system, isn't it, for classifying whether food is ultra-processed or not. I think what's hard for people to grasp is that, say, an ingredient like oil, it's theoretically processed, but the presence of oil means that people probably cook from scratch. So is that why it sometimes takes time for people to go, well, that's a bit processed, but it's probably better for me than eating a donut, say?
Yeah, I think the really hard thing for people trying to figure out what food is good and what food is bad was to distinguish processing from ultra processing and to try and disentangle the nutrients, the fat, salt, sugar, carbs, protein in our food from the complex entity that is whole food. If we think of milk as an example, milk, you can drink it straight out of the cow. You shouldn't because you'll get brucellosis, but you can. Or you could process it and turn it into traditional food like butter, cheese. And those foods have been around for thousands of years, like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, if we've got evidence of dairying in North Africa. But ultra processing is a completely different set of processes. And it's quite hard to describe them as a single entity. So the definition of ultra processed food extends to 5 pages of a UN document where it's been formally written down. And that's because you have to encompass all of these different technologies that we use to make everything from a diet drink through to a ready meal or a frozen pizza. They require different processes. And some of them are physical, you're grinding and extruding. Some of them are thermal, you're deep frying or pressure cooking. Some of them are chemical, you're using enzymes to interesterify oil. And then you have all the additives. And so it was complex to develop an idea that we needed a definition of complete food products rather than just trying to understand them in terms of their fat, salt, sugar. And where we've ended up is that there is a huge difference between a cake that you bake at home and a cake that you buy in the supermarket. They look the same, they might taste similar, but they interact with your body in a completely different way.
And ultra-processed food has actually been around for ages. Well, much longer than I realised.
Yeah, that surprised me. So before I started writing the book, I figured it was invented in the 60s with microwaves.
Absolutely. You know. I think of America for some reason. Like,
and those amazing meals with the kind of iconic ads and airline food and all that stuff. Yeah. And all the progress that that brought, women entering the workplace because they weren't tied to a cooker all day, and the good things that came with convenience and the reduction of manual labour at home. But no, it was, I give 1879 as the sort of starting year when a guy called Fallberg extracted saccharin from coal tar. We don't think of saccharin, which is sweet and low, so it's sachets all over America have some saccharin in them, and it's a widely used artificial sweetener. We don't think of that as coming from coal and being well over 100 years old. There was an inversion for me where I started to understand the food system completely differently. And it happened when I started talking to the bankers, because the bankers are the only people who understand the world in general. But specifically, the bankers who deal with food companies understand what the purpose of food companies is. And we think, you and I, the food system exists to supply food to me. And it doesn't exist for that reason. It exists to extract money from me and hand it to the people who own the food companies, which might incidentally be my own pension. But that's the flow. It's an inverted flow of money. And so the project of the food companies is separate from my health. My health is an irrelevance. They're not trying to make us ill.
Yeah.
It's just a byproduct. But what they are trying to do is take the cheapest possible ingredients and use them to make food that we will eat in the largest possible quantities.
That's what I really love about this book. It isn't saying to people, don't eat this food. You're honest about the effects of the food. You're not saying, only eat this. But you don't point the finger of blame at anyone, including the companies, actually. There's a bit where you talk about the purpose of business is to make money. They just aren't thinking about our health. It's not that they necessarily even don't care. It's just that it's of no concern to them. It's not part of the plan. Or would you say that they...
Well, it's almost they do care, but they're unable to stop. So I came to think of the food companies as quite pathetic. So I spoke to someone at a massive investment fund at BlackRock, and she said... You do realise that, she used Danone as the example. She said, you do realise that Danone are not in control of their business model. And this was a kind of whiplash moment for me. Her point was that if Danone start making food that we eat less of, for example, because healthy food should fill us up and we stop eating it. And ultra-processed food doesn't do that for lots of reasons. If Danone started to make all their ultra-processed products a bit less edible and more satisfying, and we started eating 10% less of each meal, and spending 10% less money 10% less often, the Danone share price would fall. And that's what happened. So the guy running Danone, Michel Faber, tried to do this. He turned Danone into a social enterprise, and activist investors, it wasn't BlackRock, it was another group called Bluebell Capital, said, yeah, we need our money. We're answerable to all our investors. You can do social good if you like, but not on our dollar. So Faber was fired, essentially, and Danone went back to doing what Nestle and all the other companies do, and their share price went back up and everyone was happy. So many of the people I spoke to in the food industry were like, we would love to stop selling addictive garbage to children, but we can't stop. And when you say, well, could you go to using... I spoke to the head of an ice cream company, Ibrahim Najafi, who's head of Froneri, the second biggest ice cream company in the world. He said, well, why can't you use eggs instead of emulsifiers? And he just said, well, we can use eggs, but they carry a risk of bacterial infection. They carry salmonella potentially. And they'd just literally in the news the day before I spoke to him, been a salmonella scare. And he said the cost of an egg yolk compared to the cost of the synthetic emulsifiers they use is massive. So you can get almost the same creamy custardy thing that you get from eggs by using a chemical that costs 100 times less and doesn't have bacterial risk. So I'm quite sympathetic to the trap they're in.
Especially startups, I guess, because they've got really small margins.
The margins are so tight in these businesses.
Yeah.
There's no margin in any of these companies. The arms race between Tesco and Sainsbury's and M&S, we've only got 5 or 6 supermarkets in this country. And the number one thing that customers want is cheap food.
Yeah.
Because in the UK, we don't have any money. We live in such an unequal society. Everything is so expensive. Our transport, our energy, our accommodation. We're paying so much on rent. There's nothing left for food. So consumers are hammering the supermarkets down. The supermarkets hammer the suppliers, the producers. So we end up with kind of the root problem being poverty and inequality.
And you also talk about the fact that UPF, ultra-processed food, is easier to freeze. It lasts for longer. there's a brilliant moment where you talk about being in the park and your daughter having an ice cream and you realising it hasn't melted and just going, hang on.
You've got kids the same age. Now, have you, I guess you haven't had ice cream since you read the book. We're recording this at the end of spring. But have you,
I've had ice cream. I've been in Portugal.
Oh, have you?
Yes,
I did. And have you noticed the warm foam that you're left, that it doesn't melt?
Absolutely. So I had an ice cream about 3 days ago, a salted caramel ice cream in Portugal, and thought, I think this is covered in bacterial slime, and then just carried on eating it because I remembered that bit.
The xanthan gum.
The xanthan gum. And she got it out and it was in a perfect ball.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, you know, she's just got it out. And then as I was eating it, I thought, it should be dripping down the sides of the cone by now. It should be disappearing. It should have become water. It's really hot. It's one of those things that you just don't think about.
And I found what staggered me is that no one I know has ever read an ingredients list, really. I mean, there are some fanatics who do, but until I became, as a scientist, interested in ultra-processed food, I'd never read the ingredients on anything. I had no idea what was in my bread.
So the only time I started to read it was when I had migraine-associated vertigo, and I'm fine now, but I had to give up lots and lots of things for months. I had to give up any kind of MSG. And the consultant said, if you see flavourings, have you ever noticed flavourings? And I was like, I guess. I just thought that was kind of salt or maybe. And he was like, no, that's a kind of umbrella term for lots of nasty things. That he was like, you have to truly give up MSG. And that's the only time that I've read these ingredients lists. And that's the first time that I'd.
And did it work?
Yeah, it did work. It did work. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so. I don't mention migraines in the book, but I think there are so many conditions that we accept that we all just live with. My daughter's got terrible eczema, and so does half the other kids in her class. And the ones that don't have eczema all have asthma. And we just go, well, this is a modern life, isn't it? And yet we are constructing our bodies out of really quite bizarre substances that we've never encountered before that have very powerful effects on our physiology. So it's not surprising to me that your migraines went away, but I wish I'd known that when I was writing that chapter.
Oh, well, when it reprints, like, you can interview me for the migraine chapter. So there are so many brilliant people in it, and I feel like I know them because one of the really, really brilliant things about this book is its warmth and kindness. You talk about obesity as a disease, not something that's to do with lack of willpower or anything like that. I really, really love that. And also, you, as I said, you aren't telling people not to eat UPF. It's really hard not to. And I know some people do achieve it, but it's tricky, especially if you're a parent or someone who hasn't got very much money, or you're kind of just living a chaotic life. You haven't got time to cook. So you have all this research in the book. You link it in with you and your brother Zand, who you work with a lot. And also, with each person you speak to, you give a little nugget of information about them. And that was so brilliant as a reader to have that. And it just made everything that they said come alive. It didn't.
There was so much more I wanted to say about all of them. So one of the people I interviewed at a bank is called Robert. And I said, are you a Bob or a Robert? And he said, no, I'm always Robert, because my husband is Bob and we couldn't both be Bob. And I just, it was one of those sort of writerly problems where I put it in and it looked sort of somehow ostentatious, but it was such a lovely little moment where I couldn't find a way of including it. I found it extremely hard. I don't know if you've had this problem with working through the drafts of how to describe people in ways that aren't marginalizing or stigmatizing or somehow drawing attention to their physical appearance. So I read lots and lots of other authors and looked like, how do you actually describe people? And so I went to the New Yorker a lot. And you start to look at the New Yorker and go, oh, they quite often just go, someone's kind of bald and fat. And you're like, whoa. You know, New Yorkers, particularly from 10 years ago, they'll do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I tried not to do that. But yeah, that
you
was, I'm glad
well,
you
didn't
noticed
do that.
That.
But it made us feel like we were in the room with you. It was just a little essence of them that made us go, oh, I totally imagine
you
everything
could,
coming out of
their
mouth.
You could hear their voice, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it made such a difference. It made me invest in the information that I was being told in a completely different way, because it felt really personal then. It never felt too science-y for someone who really doesn't know any of this stuff.
It's interesting you talk about the science, because the book was written with several people in mind. And there are times where I'm just having an argument with someone that you, the reader, don't know, you've never met, And I'm in this kind of internal battle because to discuss food is to have a row, right? Everyone has an opinion about food. Everyone's absolutely certain about their own food, about what food does to them, about sugar, about fat.
And it's so linked to emotions for
right,
most
and,
of us.
And it's tangled up with stigma. So I knew there would be readers, you know, I am medically overweight and I have many friends and patients who, until you are a physician and people talk to you about this, you don't understand the burden that people with diet-related disease, whether it's that they've had a stroke or a heart attack or whether they live with a weight problem or a metabolic problem like type 2 diabetes, you don't understand the burden and the shame they carry around with them. And the latest research is showing that those conditions carry more stigma than any other personal characteristic, particularly with the way doctors treat their patients. And the medical profession has been appalling with making our patients feel that they are responsible for things that are entirely to do with the world around them. The structural violence in society, you know, the food system is violent. It hurts people physically.
You use the word violent twice, actually. And it really, it really stuck out to me in the notes that you saw at the beginning. You described the violence of the environment that people live in, the food environment. And then later on, much later, you use the word violent again. And it's such a powerful word because the way the book frames it is, I felt like humans are part of a chain. People are extracting money from us. It's the first time I've ever thought about that. As you said earlier, we're just there to...
You're there to be mined.
Yes.
Just and mined if, for coins.
And if crops can be fed to us through animals, as it were, i.e. the animals eat it, then the meat is processed and the meat is given more shelf life and cheapened by lots of different methods and can make lots of more meals as a result, they get more money. But we're essentially eating that crop that the animal ate in the first place.
I think of it as like it's repurposing waste. So you grow soy and you feed it to a cow and you're left with beef. But along that journey, you've crushed the soy into a flake to feed it to the cow. And the flake's very proteinaceous because the cows like the protein. And you're left with some soy oil. Now, soy oil isn't useful and it doesn't taste nice. But you can refine it, bleach it, deodorize it, interesterify it, and turn it into a solid fat that's synthetic butter. So we've repurposed the soy oil and it can now enter the food chain and it can be added to anything. And you'll see soy fat and soy oil and soy protein isolate added to everything from your nutritional drinks to your lasagnas to your breads. It's in everything, soy flour. But the soy is hyper cheap because we're growing it at vast scale, usually in the southern Amazon, to feed to cows. So it's sort of subsidized and it's the cheapest possible crop. Then you get beef. You kill your cow, you take your beef, but you're left with snouts and testicles and bones and tendons and ligaments. And you can spread them on fields, you can feed them to dogs, or you can break them down, refine them, chemically modify them further and turn them into makeup, you know, all your collagen in your... I don't know why I'm pointing at you.
Well,
but, you know,
I've got foundation on your book.
My wife last night was applying her collagen, what would it be?
Oh, like moisturiser sort of cream.
It's like a serum thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that's a way of adding 1,000 times more value to beef tendons than you'd get from feeding it to a domestic dog or giving it in chicken food. And there's nothing wrong necessarily with eating modified beef tendons. It's good to be efficient. But it should make us reflect that these aren't things we're normally eating. I mean, the other thing that amazed me was the guy Paul Hart, who's become a sort of friend. I mean, he's such an eccentric. And I shouldn't say sort of a friend. He has become a friend. He explained about these Uncle Tom Cobbley labels. Did you know this? Have you ever heard this expression?
I mean, no. And I listened to the folk song. Such a beautiful...
So Paul goes, look, Chris, what you'll notice with fats is on your ingredients, you have Uncle Tom Cobbley labels. And I thought Uncle Tom Cobbley was some sort of modified fat, but it's an old folk song. And it ends with a long list of people, the final one of whom is Uncle Tom Cobbley and all. So it's a way of... Uncle Tom Cobbley is like a long list of random stuff or people. So on your digestive biscuits, on your energy bars, in your cereal, you'll often see it'll be like sunflower oil, palm fat, palm stearin, and mango kernel fat. And all of these are absolutely interchangeable fats. They're just fats extracted from plants that can be added as synthetic butter. And the mango kernel fat was the most interesting because, you know, when you buy mango chunks in plastic in a supermarket, obviously they're left with the nut in the middle. And if you smash that nut open, there's a very bitter, fatty nut inside that you couldn't eat. No one eats mango nuts. You can't buy them in a shop. But if you crush the oil out of it and chemically modify it, you turn it into a tasteless solid fat that you can add to stuff. It's a fantastic thing in a sense that we can take our mango kernels and turn them into edible fat. But it's a symptom of a food system that is not driven by a concern for what that fat will do for us, but by a desire to repurpose waste.
Yeah, it's not like when you learn about cave people and they used every bit of the animal and they made bags and weapons and...
Yeah, I think that's right. It's not sort of efficiency because life is precious. It's efficiency because of a vicious commercial pressure. And some of the project of the book is to disgust you. You know, you say, I'm trying not to tell people what to do. But my only invitation at the beginning is, please eat along while you read this book. Like, just dig in, eat the food. I mean, you're going to eat it anyway. You might as well. You're part of an experiment being run by the food companies. They get almost all of the data. The only data you get is how terrible you feel. So you might as well do the experiment for yourself. Eat the food, taste the foams, and start to figure out, do you really enjoy this food? And I think, I don't know if you found this, but has it changed your emotions and sensations when you're eating your warm foam ice cream in Portugal?
Yes.
Does it feel different in the mouth? Do you start to, maybe it isn't quite ice cream?
Absolutely. It's made me think far more about what I buy and what I eat already.
And you were doing that already, of course, because of the migraine.
Yeah, although the migraines have gone now. I'm still a bit careful with aged cheese, but apart from that. But I think actually knowing all the stuff about the migraines did make me eat cleaner, as it were. And especially with what the kids eat, I am now more conscious, I guess. I think the invitation to people to just be aware that they're in an experiment and to carry on as they were is far more effective than going, you have to do this, you have to do this. Because at the end of the day, anyway, our responsibility lies with ourselves. You know, you could read 1,000 books that told you never eat a processed thing. It will do you such damage. You can't do it. You can't do it. I'd probably still go and have a burger afterwards.
We're perverse, aren't we? Because there are two things at the core of that idea of like, please keep eating the food. I'm not telling you what to do. One of which is the fact that it's very well evidenced. So there's this famous book, The Alan Carr Easy Way to Quit Smoking. And it's kind of a cheesy book, and all my smoker friends had read it and used it to quit. But when I looked it up, it's got loads of evidence. So the World Health Organization recommend this method, and there's a lot of evidence that if you engage with harmful things, if you use them and consume them whilst learning about them rather than resisting them, there's something about the forbidden fruit, or if you make the fruit no longer forbidden, it loses a bit of appeal. So some of it was the evidence. Some of it was that I'd had this very powerful experience of speaking to a scientist, Fernanda Rauba. I can remember, and every time I used the word food, she'd go, it's not food, Chris. She was Brazilian. I won't do the accent. She's like, it's not food, Chris. It's not food. You must stop calling it food. It's ultra-processed food.
And she called it an ultra-processed edible substance.
Ultra-processed edible substance. She was so fanatical about it. And at the end of the meal, I'd put the phone down, brilliant, wrote up my notes, and then I ordered KFC hot wings for dinner. And always be my favourite food. I could not eat them. They tasted the same, but they had become repulsive. They'd become contaminated in some way. It was a gift she'd given me. She'd sort of unlocked the cage of addiction. You know, she'd released me from this prison. And I don't say this lightly. Like, I had a really addicted relationship with this food to the point of eating so much I'd vomit. And you know, as a man, if you're not overweight and men are judged less, you sort of get away with it. And it was never a terrible problem, but it was peculiar looking back. And Zand had this as well. But the other experience was nagging my brother had done him such harm. He lived with a lot of obesity for many years. And me nagging him, there was this psychologist who said, for him to lose weight will be to lose an argument with you. And I don't want to put the reader in the position of making them feel judged. It's not their responsibility, but I want them, if they want to quit the food, I want them to be empowered to do it, but it's up to them and they're going to own it.
There's a brilliant example you use in your radio show with Zand where you say if you're sitting on the sofa and you decide to go and put the bins out, you feel good. But if the person next to you says, as you start, I thought it was just so brilliant.
My wife and I, we've had huge rows where like as you get up to do some menial household chore, they're like, oh, could you do the very thing you're getting up to do? And it makes me furious.
Because
when I do things of my own volition, I get a sort of credit for it. Like I'm like, well, I'm heroically taking out the bins. But when you've just been told to do it, you're then the servant of the person asking.
Absolutely. And you're fulfilling a duty then, and it only brings you back to neutral. It doesn't bring you. But you see it with kids as well. If I've been saying brush your teeth, and then she potters off and finally brushes them, and I go, good girl. She goes, get off, because it's so annoying that I'm saying, good girl, because she wants to have done it of her own volition and not to be.
That.
Yeah, it really irritates her, and I do get it. It's the, I suppose it's the same thing.
I wonder
really.
If I could harness this more with my own children. A lot of the time, I forbid them from doing things that are good for them. I put broccoli on the table and I say, this is my broccoli. It's for the grown-ups. It's not for you. Do not eat it. And then I go and do something else and they'll eat all the broccoli just to annoy me.
Well, I'm going
to
try that.
I mean, it's like
that.
Classic reverse psychology. One of my daughters is particularly perverse and will only disobey me. So she hasn't yet clocked that this is a trick we can run. You know, she's three.
Yeah, keep doing it. I'm totally going to steal that. We do ask everyone to bring objects onto this podcast. And actually, we've talked about the first one that you've brought in inverted commas. I don't know if you have actually brought it. If you have, I'll have one. It's KFC hot wings, which are
we could get some,
your,
get some delivery. You can eat them all.
We won't continue until we have the hot wings. I know exactly what you mean about hot wings. And there's something about the joy of going to KFC and kind of going, I think we had similar childhoods, having listened to a bit of stuff about yours. My mum was really, really into cooking, lots of lentils and things like that, sneaking shards of carrot into soup and so on.
And we never of carrots.
we didn't ever have chips or maybe sausages now and again, but no fish fingers even, or, you know,
really?
It was all fresh.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, actually, with the result that when we went to other people's houses, we used to go crazy.
Yeah.
If they had a soda stream or if they had biscuits, we would eat until we felt really sick because we couldn't believe we were allowed, or at parties, you know. So, I mean, she was doing her best, but I think maybe it was too far the other way in terms of healthy eating. But I think most people have it within them. Like, it's exciting to kind of go to KFC or to get a pizza or to... When I was in Portugal, we got these frozen things from the supermarket that looked like Yorkshire puddings. We just put them in the oven and I didn't know what they were. I thought about you because I thought, this is kind of UPF central. All the ingredients were in Portuguese, but I could even then I could make out the hyphens saying kind of mono, something or other. And they were like miniature Yorkshire puddings with what was like coronation chicken inside, which just melted. Oh. And that was the real time I thought about texture because... And no one else liked these. So I was like, there were
like
six.
A sort of vol-au-vent? Or like those cheese puff things?
Yeah, like puff pastry. You know,
I know,
about the size of Yorkshire puddings, but closed, like a dumpling.
So
you could...
Yeah, the Brazilians have cheese ones. With
a
blob of... It's like almost a... Yeah, I can picture it completely.
It was
a Yorkshire
incredible.
Pudding with a stuffing, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was like I was in heaven.
Yeah.
And they were really buttery. And I was like, I don't know what's in these. I quite like the fact that I don't know what's in them. And no one else wanted them. The kids didn't like them. Ellis didn't like them. So I ate four and I'd already eaten pizza and salad. And I was like, I can't stop eating them. I just can't stop. It wasn't like Whole Food where you go, I've had enough now. I feel full. I was like, I feel like I'll never feel full.
You're not in control.
Yeah. But so why is that? Is that because of the ingredients or the additives or just kind of the whole shebang?
You're getting to the kind of core of the problem. It's because the products are addictive. So they're not addictive for everyone, but no substance is addictive for everyone. So when we say ultra-processed food is addictive, it is certain products are addictive for certain people. In the same way that some people don't get addicted to cigarettes. I can have a cigarette once a fortnight and I never think about cigarettes. I'm one of those people. I mean, I don't anymore, but I could when I was young. Drinks, you know, I will never have a problem relationship with alcohol. I can have a beer on a Friday night and stop at one beer. But for those products that are engineered that tap into your brain, it's not any one thing. It's not the sugar, it's not the fat, it's not the emulsifiers. It's the whole thing. And this has been the kind of bugbear of nutrition science, is what scientists love to do is to look at a problematic entity, whether it's your phone, that you might be addicted to, whether it's gambling or a food substance or a drug, and go, what is the one thing about that that's addictive? And with cigarettes, it's been easy. With booze, it's been easy. Cigarettes, it's nicotine. Booze, it's ethanol. Heroin, it's the diamorphine. With food, it's complicated because it's the entire product. That these products have been engineered. Most of them are quite old. So if we think of Pringles were invented in the 60s, roughly. So Pringles have been around for more than 50 years. And every year, they're cycled through taste testing, reformulation, a trial of marketing, and they're slightly improved, just slightly tweaked, and everything is slightly improved. The ingredients get a bit cheaper, the additives get a bit enhanced. And so they become, through this sort of iterative process of redesign and reevaluation, they become more and more and more edible to the point where they are really impossible to stop. And we have some idea about what generates the food addiction. So one of the problems with ultra-processed food is it's incredibly soft. And it turns out that the thing we're probably getting addicted to is the calories that we get. That seems to be where we're locating the reward. So if we get the sugar and the fat and the protein in, that's what we become addicted to. And we tag the flavors to that signal. So for me, it's the hot wings. I eat hot wings. Now, they're soft, and you can very quickly eat 600 calories of hot wings. So I get this buzz, and the speed is important. So if you think of all addictive substances, whether it's cigarettes, cigarettes are way more addictive than chewing tobacco or tobacco leaves. People used to put tobacco leaves against their skin and get a little buzz from them. Cocaine that you snort is way more addictive than coca leaves if you chew them. Heroin, if you inject it, is much more addictive than slow-release morphine sulfate that we give people as a painkiller. Shots of alcohol, way more addictive than low-alcohol beer. So there's something about getting the reward and your brain's ability to link the fat, salt, sugar from the hot wings to the very specific spice combination that creates this addictive pattern. And then you create these other links with all the advertising and the shop front and the music and the jingle and the ads. And so it's the entire experience you've become addicted to.
The work that's gone into it is staggering.
It's millions of hours of design, research, development, not done in an evil way. It's not done to go like, we're going to make people obese. It's gone because they have to sell products. And you need to sell one more hot wing every year.
And you even talk about the shape of the Pringle, the fact that it rests on your tongue.
Yeah.
That even the
shape of it's congruent
been
exactly with your tongue, yeah. It's probably an accident. They just found this way of making it, and that was the chip that survived in the marketplace and has become this iconic thing. And then there's this mismatch thing. So the Pringles are interesting, I think, for two reasons. First of all, they contain these flavor enhancers. So these molecules like guanylate and glutamate, monosodium glutamate. Now, these are naturally occurring in food, right? You eat fermented foods or umami dishes, and you get a signal in your mouth that tells your body digestible protein is on its way. But when you eat a Pringle, you get the savory umami taste from these synthetic flavor enhancers, but the protein never arrives. All you get is potato starch. And it may be that sort of mismatch where you're like, that was nice, but I'm missing something, and you go and have another. And the same might be true of artificial sweeteners. Sweet taste in the mouth, but no sugar arrives. You're unsatisfied. You had a nice mouth thing, but you're left unsatisfied.
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
And the Pringles, also the thing I loved about the Pringles that I didn't know about was calling the lawyers about the VAT law, the lawsuit where there was this legend that I sort of vaguely remembered, like someone had sued someone because Pringles weren't really potato crisps. And it turned out that it was Procter & Gamble bringing the lawsuit against HMRC to say there is so little potato in these that we should not be charged value-added tax because they're not really a potato snack. And weirdly, in British law, potato snacks are the thing we charge VAT on, whereas corn snacks we don't, like Doritos, are not subject to this tax. So part of ultra-processing is all the lawsuits that go alongside the food to try and create these tax efficiencies. And we pay for those lawsuits. You know, the government had to hire these incredible, you know, Queen's Counsel lawyers to tackle the bigwigs at Procter & Gamble. And after three appeals and tribunals, and Procter & Gamble did eventually lose, so Pringles are still subject to VAT, but Doritos are not.
It's amazing. It's a bit like
so
the Jaffa
weird.
Cake
exactly.
biscuit stroke
yeah.
cake thing.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it is about extracting money
yeah.
from the product yeah. in the most efficient way.
The Jaffa cake thing was because there's this weird law where if it's a cake, it's not subject to VAT, but if it's a biscuit, it is, I think. Cakes, for some reason, are not a luxury food. The price of the thing won't change. The company will profit the 20% they save because there's no, that you can't tell from looking across the range of snack products, some of which are VATed and some of which aren't. You can't tell which are the cheap ones.
Well, let's move on to your next object. This is something to treasure.
This is my yellow cow.
It is, yes.
Teddy. So I've had Yellowcow slightly older than me. He was given to me before I was born. In fact, he was given to Zand, but I liked Yellowcow. Zand had a blue cow. We don't know what's happened to blue cow. Anyway, I kept Yellowcow. I put Yellowcow in because I still sleep with him every night. I feel like I'm a reluctant science communicator. There are a lot of people on the BBC who talk about science who are evangelists, who believe that science is an amazing way of understanding everything about the world. And as someone who has a PhD in molecular biology and uses science, I find science a really limited way of understanding the world. And something about Yellowcow represents this because I have some belief about Yellowcow as being more than an inanimate object, that he has some property that I can't quite name that's quite important to me. And I would be almost as upset today if I lost him as if I've had a child lose a teddy bear, and it's grief, it's real grief. So he speaks to something, I guess, in my psyche where I feel that I always want to caveat all scientific discussions by saying this is just a very limited tool for predicting a few very small things about the future. It doesn't help us understand anything about the world. And if we're going to understand food, the science won't help us with the inequality, the social context, and the immorality of the way our food system works.
I think the other thing that brings to your work is a sense of fun. And the book is also very funny, that wouldn't be there if you didn't have this openness to... There's a kind of softness around the edges of what you do that makes what you say far more compelling than if it was just dry information. Perhaps a sense of fun about life.
Or a sense of uncertainty.
Yeah.
I'm quite...
The edges may be just slightly softened.
Yeah. And it's a problem when you're communicating about this stuff, because I think what a lot of people want is just people say, like, tell me what to do. What should I do with my diet? Tell me, Chris. And I'm like, I've no idea what you should do. Here is some information, and I can't tell you how to behave because you will fail and it will be my fault, or you'll succeed and it will be my success. I feel very unsure about exactly what to tell anyone to do. There aren't clear answers. And maybe Yellowcow helps with all that.
I think the fact that you do the kids stuff as well, I feel like you never patronise kids at all. There's just this joy in communicating the science. And that carries over into the adult stuff. There's just this kind of joie de vivre.
So the first draft I wrote as a much more naive book, and it was really fun writing it as an idiot who was kind of wandering into these discussions and asking dumb questions. Then almost everyone involved in production went, we actually need you to be a physician and a scientist, and you are an expert, and you have to write the book as an expert. And I was like, oh, it's much less fun to write it like that.
What kind of questions can you remember?
It was things like, there's a character in the book called Chris Snowden. In the first draft, he was much more of my nemesis, but he's such an intriguing guy. He's at the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is a free market think tank, and the whole book could just be sort of about Chris Snowden's various positions on food and weight and child health, because we have such opposite views on the world. So it was very fun when you've got a sort of character, and he was very generous with his time. And I disagree with him about almost every single thing in the entire world. He was a great foil, but anyway, yeah. We removed all the Chris Snowden chapters because the whole book was about him. I mean, you must find this when you write. It's fun to write your own confusion or your own stupidity or the moments of understanding.
And it feels sometimes that you can really drill down into an instinctive reaction, almost like a child would have.
As a comedian, you can undermine your own credibility because that's where the humour comes from. But if you're trying also to communicate some quite serious things about life and death, then you can't always do that.
Yeah. And also, it has to be factually sound. You know, did you enjoy writing it?
I enjoy having written it.
Yeah.
I needed 3 years to write this book, and I took a year, and that had big impacts on mainly my wife and my children and lots of other work. And I'd done a lot of sort of pre-work. You know, I already knew quite a lot of it before I started writing. It's not like it was done hastily or carelessly, but it just sort of took a lot out of my life, partly because it felt urgent to get it out. That's the reason I compressed it, is because we've had a national food strategy released. And there is a moment, I think, where there is an understanding that there is a changing way we're thinking about food, that the old understanding of fat's bad or the sugar's bad that's changing. So I think people are at a moment where they're like, what is this ultra-processed food? And I'd done some broadcasting about it, so it felt urgent to get it out. Bits of it are fun when you're writing the people, and doing the research is fun, but I just find organising these complex thoughts about the philosophy of the food system really difficult.
It's a nuanced subject in ways I didn't realise. There's a bit where you talk about how the reason it can be so hard to research UPF is because the food companies create these jigsaw pieces that kind of look like proper jigsaw pieces, but they don't quite fit together.
So that was probably the hardest bit to write. There has long been a theory that everyone understands, basically, that if you go for a run, you burn calories and you can just eat a bit more. And if you don't eat more, you'll lose weight. And that's completely wrong. So if you do lots of exercise, you don't burn any more calories than if you do no exercise.
Yeah, this blew my mind.
It blew my mind. So as a physician and someone who's done lots of exercise, if you and I were to go and live as hunter-gatherers or subsistence farmers or coal miners, we would not burn any more calories than if we did podcasting and writing all day. And all of the evidence that says we burn more calories with exercise has come from the Coca-Cola Corporation. And so they have littered the scientific literature with literally hundreds, possibly thousands of papers saying, oh, there's this, you can do energy balance, you can burn off excess calories. They funded public health programs like exercise is medicine. They funded institutes to promote this message. And so the jigsaw piece of science where you're just trying to discover the truth about calories becomes full of all these wrong pieces that look, they sort of feel correct instinctively. You're like, well, yeah, I go for a run, I burn calories. It says so on my watch and on the running machine. But it's all a fabrication. And I take a whole chapter to explain why pandemic obesity is entirely due to food. It has nothing to do with inactivity or exercise. And we are absolutely sure about that. And the reason that we all believe otherwise is the Coca-Cola company.
It's scary.
It made me think about lying, because you must have had this. When you want to conceal something, whether it's often being pregnant, that's a thing we often want to conceal early on, or you want to conceal that doing exercise doesn't burn more energy, you have to tell lies. You can't just keep it quiet because people start to notice. So you're not,
yes. Yeah.
Why aren't you drinking? Or you're not, that's weird, you're not doing this or X, Y, or Z. Or it's all kind of, so you have to start fabricating things. That is what the food companies do, is they create fabrications that paper over the truth. And so just extracting the truth from the science becomes harder.
Well, let's move on to your next object. Is this your favourite song? Something to dance to.
It's a dance remix of a song by Lady Gaga called Bloody Mary. And it's Lyra's, my daughter's favourite song. It represents a form of music that we might think of as being ultra-processed music. So one of the things I started noticing, once you get your head around the idea of food, the purpose of the food being for this kind of financial system of generating profit, you start to realise so many things in our world that are quite sticky and addictive and Moorish are also in some way ultra processed. So a lot of the music that my kids like, a lot of the cartoons they watch, a lot of the apps on my phone itself, these things are engineered to drive excess consumption and fundamentally to extract money from us. And so I think my response to this kind of music is, it's sort of comic. Lyra will do her funny little bum wiggle dance to it. It's like, I don't want to ban this, but I do think it's important, any more than I want to ban ultra-processed food. But maybe it's worth considering there might be some blurry difference between that music and other music. And it's not like there's pure music that people make for no money and has nothing to do with profit. You know, everyone from Bob Dylan to Mozart's been paid for their music, but it's those artists are maybe not part of a system that is relentlessly about delivering equity growth to venture capital firms. So there aren't these clear boundaries. I mean, in your world, there will be sort of comedy and plays and television that it's kind of someone's cranking the handle on it. It's not produced with love.
I often feel like that about remakes, or you feel like something's derivative.
Franchises, you know, the sixth edition of one of the movies, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes people look a bit dead behind the eyes. And sometimes comics have writers, which is generally not the case these days. I think when comedy, you know, a few decades ago, lots of people had writers. Comics who are on telly, who have regular telly shows, often have to have writers, but you wouldn't have a writer if you were just doing the circuit. Some people do, and you go, they've got a writer. It all should be coming from them, from their own page.
Can you tell if you watch a comic who's got a sort of writer and is part of some big kind of comedy factory thing? Can you? Is there a thing where you're like,
I'm laughing,
but something isn't quite connecting
here? Yeah, if you disregard telly, because I think that's a completely different thing, but say live on the circuit, I think you can, because they feel like presenters or actors doing an impression of a stand-up. And it's a little bit like you say about eating the Pringle and expecting protein and it not being there.
Yeah.
You're kind of laughing, but you're going, I'm laughing because there's a pause and everyone's laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
So ultra processing is around us everywhere. And it's not necessarily terrible, but it will eventually destroy everything. The ultra processed food will destroy all of our knowledge of food culture, all of our information about real cooking. It will replace all traditional ethnic foods. It will get rid of everything. And I think the same, if we're not kind of conscious of this, the same can happen with all art, entertainment. You know, there's ultra-processed books, aren't there? I mean, there are books written by ghostwriters, you know.
Even AI now, the ChatGPT stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to your final object. And I do want to ask about what can be done regarding UPF. It's something from the kitchen.
So I have a really cheap Victorinox knife. It costs 16 quid. And a chef once told me that this is the only knife you ever need. And I have this fancy sharpener. It's got three little wheels. And I carry this everywhere. Whenever I go on holiday, I pack it in the hold luggage with the sharpener. I'm not a fanatical cook or a particularly great cook, but having a good sharp knife, and it doesn't need to be an expensive one, is the core of being able to cook. You know, you can chop a tomato, you can chop anything up, you can make any food you want. You can slice things thinly. So that's the one thing. And when I sharpen it, it's like it's a new object. And it's this one kind of material possession. I really enjoy it every time I use it.
How often do you sharpen it? Do you know when it needs sharpening, or do you do it kind of every Thursday?
If you chop 20 tomatoes, you can sense the blade has dulled. So if you want it sharp enough to shave with, you know, you do it, you know.
You just
After every use, yeah.
I've never sharpened a knife, and I think our knives are probably really blunt, because there's some that I know I can only use for things like broccoli, because they can sort of get through it. And it's essentially like using a teaspoon. So I think
I'll send you the link for the sharpener.
Thank
it's got
you.
Three
yes,
little
please.
I don't know if we're doing brands, but I can't remember. It's the one, I think it's, and it's got three little wheels, and it's used for global knives, but it works perfectly well with this Victorinox one, which is cheap.
Okay, next time I go to Portugal, I'm going to take the knife as well and cut up the coronation chicken Yorkshire puddings with my sharp knife. So you don't point the finger at the food industry per se. You do in a sense, but quite rightly.
They can't change.
They can't. You're not chastising them for being capitalists or saying they're pure evil. What I like is you're trying to understand the way they work. You see humans as part of a long chain of methods to extract money from, well, food or substances. But what it seems to me, tell me if I'm right, is the thing that niggles you the most is when the companies lie to the consumer or to themselves.
I don't think we can expect them to do anything else. I think the thing that really bothers me is there are two groups of people who have a choice. The food companies don't have a choice because their legal purpose is simply to make money for their owners. And if you speak to people who work in, and I spoke to like people who worked in mining corporations, and they're just like, when you're in business, what you have to do is hand in your quarterly numbers and they just have to be better than last quarter. You have a big drink, an antacid, you go to sleep, you wake up, you do it all over again. And
yeah,
that's what business
the book,
is.
They're not even going, what's going to happen in 5 years? They're going, no, we just want
it's
to know
maybe
about
6 months. But yeah. They got to lie a bit to the consumer, but that's puffery. You know, it's just marketing. It's not lies. I mean, it is lies, but in their formulation, it's like, well, we're all obligated to these guys. The people who can make a choice are doctors and politicians. And the doctors particularly who have partnered with the food industry, and it's many of my colleagues who work as broadcasting doctors, it's many of the doctors who do the science that you read about in the book, have just taken enormous quantities of money from the food industry to basically become extensions of their marketing division. And politicians and government as well has developed a partnership. And my academic area of expertise is about these conflicts of interest. And what is absolutely crystal clear to me is that you cannot solve and create a problem at the same time. And in the UK, what we have is all our food charities, whether it's Diabetes UK or Bite Back 2030, all these charities who kind of advise the government to do all this food activism, they're all funded by the food industry. And so none of them are saying obesity is a disease caused by ultra-processed food, caused by the food industry. And then if people take only one thing away from the book, it's that diet-related disease is to the food industry what lung cancer is to the tobacco industry. Now, there are lots of nuanced differences in our response. I don't think we should tax the food. We don't have to put it in plain packaging. But until we understand that link and we get the food industry away from the science, away from the doctors' associations, away from the charities and away from policymakers, we will never solve the problem. And at the moment, particularly in the UK, the government has basically a belief that it can sort of work hand in hand with the food industry and we can all be partners in bringing about population health. And that can never, ever be the case.
You just can't be impartial if...
You can't be. I mean, there are so many examples of this, but if your income as an institution depends on selling the cheapest, most addictive food to people that has to be engineered to drive overconsumption, you can't then patch up the obesity crisis with your other hand. You can't do it. Because the only way of solving it is to stop making money. And the only people who can stop the companies making money is the government. And the food industry will be great, by the way. They're going to be okay. So we know from regulating other industries, we regulate the pharma industry very tightly. They make masses of money. They're going to be fine. They're going to figure out a way of making loads of money out of real food. And this can be done. So they'll protest and they'll kick and they'll scream because they always do. But it's going to take some real political courage to just go, no, we're going to keep these guys out of the room. Now, there's an important nuance there. You have to speak to the food industry. So for the book, I went and spoke to loads of people in the food industry. You have to understand it. But when you write your policy, they cannot be looking over your shoulder and you cannot take money from them.
Do you think it can happen?
There is no appetite for it at the moment. What will create appetite? So the book is written sort of to say to everyone, you're going to have to vote for this. If everyone says, oh, right, the food companies that feed us, Nestle, Kraft Heinz, Danone, yeah, there's only a small number of them. Coca-Cola, Yum, there's not a big list. Those companies are like tobacco companies. We have to start resisting them. So we've seen this year, Nestle sponsored the major European Obesity Congress. And so some colleagues and I wrote a big letter and made a fuss and they removed the sponsorship. So there is a groundswell where I think people are really sick of having this be the only cheap food. What I think will happen is once we start labeling the food properly, so we need to put ultra-processing in our national nutrition guidance. Then we need to label ultra-processed food as harmful. And once people realise they can't afford to eat healthy food, that's when the revolution begins. But people will have to vote in the end. So the book is about creating a sort of grassroots movement. And what those grassroots want to do with the information, I can't dictate the structure of the food system. I think people will be very skillful at being angry and being activists.
Well, the book really does do that. I think by the end, I thought, I've totally changed my attitude to food. I really have.
It's so nice to hear that.
Yeah, I highly, highly recommend this book. It's not in any way lectury. It's just brilliant. All the information's there. And in the same way as you say, you know, people living with obesity or living with overweight, did you say you don't say people are overweight, you say they have overweight, which I think is really key.
It's not an identity.
No.
It's not you. It's just a thing you live with. You might live with diabetes. You might live with HIV. You might live with cancer. You might live with epilepsy. You might live with obesity. It's not you.
In that way, though, that you frame that, and I think that is the right way, you handing the information to the reader in a similar way, i.e. going, this is the situation and this is what can be done, I think is a far more effective call to arms than some, you know, than throughout the book you say, you must go and do this throughout your... It's a very gentle, effective way of communicating it and it's far more efficient, I think.
It comes partly from the experts. I mean, I spoke, and I know from my work as a doctor in low-income countries, these are problems that affect minority populations, indigenous populations, people of colour. These are not communities that someone like me can tell exactly what to do. The solutions must come from their own anthropological understanding of their communities. And they will be, you know, communities like this are very expert at solving their own problems. And we've seen it in South America, and we're seeing it in West Africa as fast food takes over. People are being very skillful at resisting it. So it really isn't for, I mean, part of the problem in this country is it's people like me, it's kind of rich white people. So if we think of the major activists in our food system, they're very much men like me. They're men of about my age, my build. They look like me. They went to schools like I did, universities that I did. And we're not the right people to redesign a food system. We really aren't. But I do have the expertise to expose the health problems and the difficulties with the science.
Well, thank you so much. I feel like this, I could have spoken to you for 4 hours. We still wouldn't have got through all your objects. Sorry, we didn't talk about your house. Yeah. Yeah, we would have had a wee break. Thanks so much for talking to me today. The book's out on the 27th of April. Thank you for listening wherever you are. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you can, please leave us a nice review. It helps to get the word out and helps other people to find us. And finally, if you want to find out more about this podcast or catch up with any episodes you've missed, please go to penguin.co.uk/podcasts, plural. And you'll find everyone from Dolly Alderton to Benjamin Zephaniah talking about their writing. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been so fun.
I've loved it too. I'm Izzy Sutty. See you next time.